Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Tim. Nice to see you. Welcome back to our National Security Podcast.
You know, it's a smoky Friday here in Washington, D.C. and up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And so it's actually a perfect day to invite our guest and colleague, Amy Roma, to talk about nuclear power and, you know, how it can help to solve a whole bunch of national security and climate problems for the 21st century. And so with that, I'll kick it over to you, Mike, to introduce Amy.
Thanks, Tim. Amy, thank you for being on the podcast. To our listeners, Amy Roma is the global energy practice leader at Hogan Lovells. Before joining Hogan Lovells, she was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Amy, welcome to the show. Why don't you please tell our listeners a little bit more about your practice and your background?
Thanks, guys. Pleasure to be here today. So I have been in the energy space my entire legal career for about 20 years, and my particular specialty is nuclear reactors, so nuclear power, as well as fusion power. And I dabble in space power and propulsion as well with radioisotope heat decay. So sounds pretty narrow, but it's actually pretty broad in applications when you look at kind of decarbonization and industrial applications. And so it's a really fun practice and changing every day.
Could you give our listeners just a little background on what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, does compared to, say, Department of Energy, and for those in, you know, the classified contracting world where I usually live, the NSA?
Yep. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is an independent government agency that provides licensing and oversight for civilian use of radioactive material. The Department of Energy has an advocacy branch for different power sources and energy sources, including nuclear, and they do that through their Office of Nuclear Energy. And within the NNSA, that oversees kind of the defense applications and the nonproliferation applications as well. And so when you're looking at a nuclear reactor in the United States, that is largely an NRC matter. It can only really overlap with the Department of Energy to the extent usually that there's some export controlled information that may be involved that involves, you know, a foreign national working in a plant. NSA, not really so much unless you're looking at kind of international safeguards obligations and their implementation, but pretty much NRC.
Nuclear power has sort of ebbed and flowed in terms of public and sort of policymaker enthusiasm over the last half century or so. And can you give our listeners kind of a thumbnail sketch of where we are now in sort of the deployment of nuclear power, both in the United States and maybe also in Europe and Japan? And then also, you know, where the trajectory of the industry is going? You know, are we looking to deploy more? And if so, why? You know, what are the trends?
Sure. So the current state of affairs in the United States is the United States has the largest nuclear fleet. We have just under 100 nuclear reactors providing about 20% of the U.S. energy supply. It's also about 55% of our carbon-free energy supply. Globally, there's about roughly 475 reactors around the world, providing about 10% of the global energy power. I'm not sure what percentage of the global carbon-free power there is, but big picture, the takeaway is the majority of the power generation that we have around the world and in the United States is from fossil fuel. And so at a time when everybody is looking at decarbonizing, you know, there's a movement away from things like coal to cleaner energy sources. And nuclear is pretty much the only baseload power source that's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week power source that is also carbon-free. Hydro is as well, but not too many people are planning on building hydro. So we've seen in recent years, as decarbonization has become more and more important. And when we start to see that some of the low-hanging fruit of decarbonization, which is building up a bunch of renewables, has created some instability in the grid, particularly in areas where there's large market penetration, like in California, that you really need to kind of pair intermittent energy sources like renewables with baseload power to ensure that the power supply can stay on. And then what we've also seen happen recently is after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we've seen a strong emphasis on energy security and resilience. And so over the years, I always found it frustrating because depending on who my audience was, I could either wear a climate change decarbonization hat or I could wear an energy security, national security hat. And I had to shift my message depending on who that is. We now seem to have the ability to walk and chew gum at the same time, where people can understand that when you put your lights on, you need to make sure that the lights turn on. And so when you decarbonize and meet the power needs that we have, you also need to make sure that you've factored in energy security and resilience to make sure that that power comes on all the time when you need it. And so we've seen a lot of countries looking to deploy nuclear. So in the United States, there's a number of advanced reactor projects that are underway. So that we just built two new nuclear power plants in the southeastern United States. And that was a project, you know, had some unfortunate schedule delays and cost overruns associated with that. But I don't know how many more large-scale nuclear projects that we're going to see in the United States. We may see an increased interest. We just don't see that right now. But where the real interest is in this next generation advanced reactors, which are not the same type of technology that have been deployed so far around the world, which is largely a light water reactor technology. But they use alternative coolants and alternative fuels and alternative designs that have more flexible applications and more passive kind of safety features. So you don't really have to do anything. They don't have a fuel meltdown. There's not going to be an explosion type thing. It's just going to run and provide power. And so we're seeing projects being built. Dow announced that it is using an X-energy reactor to decarbonize a chemical facility in Texas. And so it's using that for both carbon-free power and carbon-free process heat. That's huge because it's very difficult to abate carbon in the industrial sector because of their very high needs for reliability in their carbon-free heat source and high temperatures. And then we've seen the PacifiCorp announced that it's going to build a Bill Gates company TerraPower reactor in Wyoming to transition a coal plant into a nuclear plant. And they're looking at kind of deploying that as a fleet. One of the unique things about nuclear is it provides a lot of jobs. And so it has the ability to kind of rehabilitate communities that have been significantly and negatively impacted by a transition away from coal by providing replacement jobs that pay equal, if not higher, wages, employ a large number of people, and kind of really help shore up the economy. And then globally, we're seeing a lot of countries looking at developing nuclear. You had mentioned, Tim, Europe. So we're seeing France looking at new nuclear, UK building new nuclear. But we're also seeing countries that have not had nuclear or have limited nuclear looking at deploying it immediately. So Poland is an example. Romania is looking at expanding their nuclear program. A lot of Central and Eastern European countries, because they're trying to ensure that they have grid resilience and energy independence away from reliance on Russia. We're seeing Japan restart its nuclear power plants. And then we're seeing a number of countries across Southeast Asia and Africa looking at deploying nuclear in the near term.
Very interesting, sort of pivoting to some of the nuclear trade issues. You just mentioned Africa and Southeast Asia as areas where countries are now starting to look to deploy. You know, obviously, anyone who knows anything about Africa these days has been following the recurrent power issues in South Africa. And, you know, those are contributing, obviously, to sort of instability and lack of economic progress there. And that's an area where the United States obviously has real interest. So how can nuclear be part of Africa's, you know, solution in the 21st century? Because their power needs are just going way up and their infrastructure is probably not able to keep up with the demand.
I love that you just asked me that question, because when I think about Africa, I like to remind people that there's about 750 million people in the world that do not have access to reliable electricity. That is something a Westerner really has a hard time understanding, but a good amount of those people are in sub-Saharan Africa. So Africa needs power, and it needs power and able to raise their standard of living and to help shore up their economies. And so when I was at COP in Glasgow a couple years ago, and I was very frustrated at the conversations that people were having, because there was a lot of people from Western governments that were giving speeches where they were, you know, standing on stage telling the rest of the world what to do. And we had a whole bunch of representatives from African nations there, and they were getting very frustrated because the Western world didn't seem to understand that they didn't have power. So while the Western world was telling them what to do, they weren't doing it themselves, and they weren't coming in and financing it. And they also didn't create the problems of climate change because they didn't have the power to emit the carbon in the first place. And so talking to these folks from Kenya and South Africa, it was really interesting to me because somebody from Kenya said to me, we can't decarbonize until we carbonize. We don't have power. And he's got up on stage and he said, in the last 5 years, we've now achieved 75% electrification, and everybody clapped politely. And he goes, stop it. It is a light bulb. They just have a light bulb. And I can't tell them that they can't have more than a light bulb because climate change, which we didn't cause. So we need power. We need the cheapest form of power, and we need the most reliable form of power more than anything else. And if you want that to be carbon free, then you can come and pay for it. Otherwise, we're just going to do whatever's cheapest. At the same time, a woman from South Africa said that we have massive youth unemployment in our country. We have massive civil instability. And if we shut down our coal plants and our coal mining, we have then put those youth, even more of them, out of work, and we will have civil instability and civil unrest. We cannot just shut down coal and build wind and solar because we won't have reliable electricity. We already have constant power outages and rollouts that destabilizes the security of our country and inhibits our economic growth. And so when we look at our power supply, we need to make sure that it employs a lot of people and that it provides reliable power. So when you have those conversations, you realize that every journey is different, and you can't look at any one country and say, you need to do it this way. And so Africa is a great example. They need electricity. It needs to be cheap. It needs to be affordable. It needs to be reliable. And that's not, it could be some wind and solar, but it's going to be other power generation sources as well. And so that's why they're having kind of a significant uptick in interest in building nuclear in a lot of countries that haven't had it before, because it can kind of check all those boxes.
So in places like Africa, which are strategically significant to the United States, are any of our companies, you know, playing in that space, or have we ceded this to the Chinese as we have so much else on the continent?
Well, the Chinese and the Russians. So a few years ago, Egypt selected Russia to build a nuclear power plant in Egypt. That same year, they also announced that they were going to start letting Russia use their Air Force bases, which was the most significant Russian presence in that area since 1973. This was like 2 years ago. I think we all probably read about it recently that Egypt was also having a planned arms sale to Russia that I think they canceled. But with the significant trade relationships that develop associated with nuclear power become friendships and alliances that go into the geopolitical influence that your ability and your ability to exert on a country and with a country. And we can see that with the nuclear power plant in Egypt that Russia is providing, which, by the way, they're providing with the entire thing. They're like, here's the reactor. We're going to build it for you. We're going to finance it for you. We're going to finance it at a 3% rate of return with $30 billion loan, and we're going to supply the waste and then take it back, you know, and it's all going to be done through one entity. The Russian government is negotiating. It's a whole of country approach. And that's just not how the U.S. or many Western countries do business. And so China does the same thing. So when you look at Africa, I recently looked at a map of Africa, and in order to engage in meaningful nuclear trade, you have to have what's called a bilateral agreement for nuclear cooperation in place between each trading partner. So the country providing the technology and the country using the technology in the nuclear space. And most of Africa that is interested in any way with nuclear has already signed them with China and Russia. And we don't have them in place with the United States. They're not even under negotiation. There's not even kind of like on the radar. And so I got a phone call a couple of years ago from someone in the government in Ghana. And he said, why isn't America here? Like, why aren't you coming in here and talking to us? Because Russia and China are in here and they're putting really aggressive pushes on, and we'd like to have options, but we don't know what they are and we don't see you guys. And I was kind of dumbfounded by that because I'm in the private sector, right? I'm the head of the energy department of a law firm. And so I was like, I can pass your message along, but I'm not really the right vehicle for this, you know, concern to be relayed. And I think he just actually was a fan of like my nuclear blog. And so that's why he called me. But the point is, we're not really there. And there's a huge market opportunity and a huge kind of geopolitical significance to what the outcome could be by our lack of being there.
So geopolitically, you know, nuclear trade seems to be a lever that the United States could use. And I'm wondering, are we thinking of using it? You know, what are the discussions that you're hearing going on inside the government, if any? And are people on the Hill talking about this?
People on the Hill are very much talking about this. And so I have, in the last couple of years, I've testified a number of times before various committees. I testified before the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee. I testified before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and the Senate Environmental and Public Works Committee. And each time I was asked to talk about the national security implications of the U.S. not participating in the global market, as well as what needs to be done in order for us to participate in the global market, and then also address the economic opportunity and the decarbonization benefits, as well as staying on top of energy innovation. What I was really surprised about is that there seemed to be very strong bipartisan support. And there was certainly strong bipartisan support that was expressed on across both sides of the aisle that from a national security perspective, you know, coming out there and offering countries an alternative to what Russia and China is offering is key. And in order to do that, we needed to deploy in the United States because people don't want to be a science experiment for the Americans. They want the Americans to have built it in their country first, have shown that it works, and then built it in another country. And so we saw a number of significant legislative programs come out of that, including the Advanced Reactor Demonstration Project, which is a multi-billion dollar project to deploy advanced reactors in the United States. And those projects are all underway. We do quite a bit of work on those. And those are laying the precursors down for those countries to then sell their reactors abroad. And so we've seen significant support from the White House and the State Department and the Department of Energy at trying to take advantage of the opportunity that has presented itself with the energy crisis that has emerged in the last year or so in Europe. And a number of new projects are being explored or developed with in Poland, in Romania, for example, that use U.S. origin nuclear technology. And so that would not have been the case a couple of years ago, but now in the age of decarbonization and energy security, people's perspectives have changed kind of significantly, as well as the urgency in which they want to deploy. And so we've seen recent legislation come out of the Environmental and Public Works Committee at the Senate called the ADVANCE Act, which is now going before the full Senate for review. That would both provide some streamlining on the NRC licensing side, but as well as support the U.S. engagement in the international community, for example, by supporting the NRC in its engagement with the international community so that other countries that are looking at deploying advanced reactors can look to our regulator to help share experiences and lessons learned and recommendations and best practices. We have one of the best nuclear regulators in the world. And so getting them out there in front of other countries so that people can kind of gain the experience of their insight is really big. It would also appoint somebody at the White House that would provide advice to the president on nuclear trade. And so I'm really eager to see where that goes. Could be a pretty meaningful metric. But in any event, we've seen other legislation passed as well. The Chips and Science Act included actually a number of provisions that would support domestic manufacturing capabilities for like life-saving medical isotopes and for space to support space power and propulsion. Because in order to engage in deep space exploration, space mining, space colonization, you need to use nuclear power. It's the only power source that can provide immense amount of reliable electricity and propulsion to support those activities in space. And so we're looking at deploying space reactors as well as radioisotope heat decay systems as well, which is how, you know, the Mars rover is powered.
This is all interesting stuff. And I'd like to talk more about the space propulsion piece. Before we get to that, can you sort of explain to our listeners what you mean when we talk about advanced reactors versus maybe the older technology? And I know we've also been hearing about the development of fusion power plants. Is that a type of advanced reactor, or is that maybe more about like zero carbon emissions, or do they all go together?
So they do not go together. They are very different technologies. So I'll do advanced reactors first, and then I'll do fusion. And so advanced reactors are kind of next generation nuclear reactors. It's not your large scale light water reactor plant, which is what most of the plants around the world are, which is these 1,000+ megawatt plants, these huge, huge plants that take forever to build and construct, super expensive, but then operate forever. Advanced reactors tend to be more, it's not a one size fits all. They can be as small as like 5 megawatts up to a couple hundred megawatts. You can build one unit, you can build multiple units, so you can scale up modularly, which reduces kind of the capital intensity of the initial project. They use alternative fuels, newer technologies, newer safety designs. You know, a lot of the technology that has been deployed around the world, it has been frozen in time in the 1950s technology. And so, you know, reactors were designed and they were built and then everybody built the same thing. And so you've seen some updates and plant modernization, but when you look at a control room at a nuclear power plant, it really feels like you are frozen in time in like a movie in the 1950s. And so the new plants are intended to reduce costs, improve safety, and have more flexible applications. So that's advanced fission, but fission is still splitting apart an atom, right? Still breaking it apart. The reason fusion is different is you're on the opposite end of the periodic table. So when you think about the periodic table hanging up in science class when you were in high school, the uranium, thorium is, you know, down on the heavy side. It's like that separate chart down at the bottom, and it tends to be heavy and stay around for a really long time. Fusion is way up in the top left-hand corner where you have like helium and hydrogen and lithium. Like fusion's way up there. Fusion is, rather than splitting apart heavy atoms, you are squishing together super light atoms. It produces an immense amount of energy, but it does not produce like the high-level nuclear waste that fission does. And so one of the unique attributes, fusion is an entirely different technology, but when the fusion process stops, it stops. It doesn't keep going like it does in the fission side of things. You don't need to continue to cool things off or bad things happen, like can happen on the fission side of things. And it, the nuclear waste that it generates is largely tritium, which is pretty small volume. Tritium has a 12-year half-life, and there's already like a commercial disposal path for it. And both fission and fusion, one thing people should keep in mind is you know where all your waste is. None of it's going out in the air. None of it's being released into the environment. It's all contained. And so on the fission side, the question is, and what do you do with that waste? You can recycle it. You can dispose of it in a deep geological repository. There's a whole lot of options on that side. So it's something you don't really need to worry about on the fusion side. And we've seen a lot of developments in the fusion space in recent years. I'm actually pretty actively involved in that front. I spoke at the White House Fusion Summit. The Department of Energy has done a number of thought leadership meetings on commercialization of fusion that I've spoken at. I've included it in my Senate and House testimony. And on that side, we're seeing a very active fusion innovation community that's largely kind of come out of work that was done at universities or national labs. And so it's a lot of startup companies, but they've seen some big money behind it. And so like, I remember in like November 2021, two different fusion companies announced $1.5 billion private capital investment each. That's a huge amount of money for a technology that has not commercialized yet. Hohenlevel's just negotiated a power purchase agreement between Helion and Microsoft to provide the first commercial fusion power facility in the world. And the timeline for that is about the 2028 timeline, and that would be a 50 megawatt plant. In order to get there, a number of technical achievements and milestones need to be met, but the company has been kind of mapping those out and needing those along the way to support their commercialization schedule. And there's a number of other companies that have been doing that as well. And so we're seeing very significant private capital investment in this area, a significant increase in U.S. government interest in helping ensure that it creates an environment for facilitating the deployment of this technology, including the announcement of some private-public partnerships last week between the government and some fusion companies. And what I'm really excited about in that space is how transformative the energy source could be on the clean energy and energy security supply side as well. But in any technology where you're commercializing something that has never been done before, there's a lot of things that you need to think about. So we've been doing a lot of work on the regulatory front. We've been doing a lot of work on engaging with the international community on the non-proliferation considerations. I actually have a paper coming out with the Atlantic Council in a couple weeks on the non-proliferation considerations with fusion and how it fits within the existing export control regime. It actually fits pretty nicely in what we already have. And so that was kind of nice. It's nice when you don't have to start over on something. And then the regulatory framework, you know, we kind of made the argument that it should be a radioactive materials license and not licensed like a nuclear reactor. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission agreed, which is good because we have a client that is applying for a radioactive materials license for their like eighth generation prototype. And they need to make sure that they know their regulatory path forward. So it's been a lot of work on that front, but it's been really exciting stuff as well.
That's excellent. I appreciate the overview of all those different pieces. I think we could talk about both advanced nuclear reactors and fusion in even more detail. I don't want to leave the show without asking if you could give us an overview about the use of nuclear power and space propulsion, because I find that fascinating just from sort of an outer space technology and national security perspective. You know, just at a high level, sort of just as you've described in these other areas here, where are we now and sort of the trends there? What's the current technology in that space? And by that, I mean, I guess we're talking, as we've been saying here so far, you know, is there a U.S. lead in that space? What are other countries doing? And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention what are Russia and China doing in that area.
So we can start by saying all three of us are actively involved in that space. So Russia, China, and the United States. The nuclear power space is not new. You know, most of the kind of the space exploration, anything that's like long-term space, anything that's not where the sun is, so you can't use solar, is powered by nuclear. But most of it is radioisotope heat decay. So you put plutonium, you know, in a system, and that's powering the Mars rover, you know. And so there's still radioisotope heat decay systems. There's a number of companies, XenoPower is one of them, this client of ours, that's developing radioisotope heat decay systems for both deep sea exploration and sea power, as well as space power and propulsion. And they have some contracts with the U.S. government to deploy their technology. But if you're going to do something for a really long time and you need a lot of power and you need to make sure that the power does not go out, for example, to provide oxygen to a space colony, you need to pretty much use a nuclear reactor. Everybody recognizes that, including the U.S. government. Under the Trump administration, they actually took a number of actions to try to connect all the dots on the various government agencies that would have a say in nuclear going into space. And that includes the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense, the FAA, the NRC. And so it depends on who's using it for what. So if it's the U.S. government, so the U.S. government has sent a reactor into space before. That was a Department of Energy oversaw that project. But if it is a commercial project and it is for a commercial space application and DOE is not involved or DOD is not involved, then you need the NRC to kind of step in. The NRC does not have jurisdiction like on the moon. But under the Atomic Energy Act, you cannot build a reactor without an NRC license. And so that's one of the things that I'm helping companies map out right now. And I can't tell you the number of companies that have reached out to me who tell me we are not regulated because the NRC doesn't regulate the moon. And so we could just go ahead and build a nuclear reactor and send it into space and nobody cares. And I'm like, well, hold on. There's a regulatory gap that will be filled by somebody. We just don't know who yet. It's not going to be a free-for-all in space. But it's also not a free-for-all on Earth. Like, you can't build a nuclear reactor without having a license. And so companies are starting to realize that now. And so it's important for the NRC to know this is coming. I think they see this is coming. I know NASA has put out some pretty aggressive RFPs for kind of projects that they would hope would be purely commercial, that the NRC would need to license the Earth-based applications. And I would imagine that companies want to test the reactors before they shoot it up into space to make sure it works. And in order to do that, you again need a license. So it's an area where we're mapping it out as we go along. But being aware of what the law is, as well as the applicable regulations, is key to making sure that you don't have surprises that emerge on critical path to deployment.
Well, this has been fascinating. Amy, thank you very much for covering all these different topics. I think we could talk further about any one of these. I'm very interested in the space propulsion piece, and we could sort of pick that up again. But we've covered a lot here. Thank you for being on the show. I think we're going to probably have you back on again as things develop further along. But this has been a wonderful session. So thank you again for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'm a big fan of the podcast, too. Thanks for doing these.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.